Welcome to the Terawatt Space Podcast. This is Aravind. In this podcast, I attempt to demystify the developments in space tech by interviewing thought leaders, entrepreneurs, and investors in the space industry. Today, I have a very interesting guest, one who wears three different hats, a self-proclaimed space enthusiast, a venture capitalist, and a space entrepreneur, Delian Asparuhov. Delian is a principal at Founders Fund, a San Francisco-based venture capital firm that is invested in SpaceX, Palantir, Facebook, Airbnb, and more. Delian also recently co-founded Varda Space Technologies, that is building factories in space in order to manufacture products for use on Earth. In this episode, Delian and I talk about his story, how he juggles between his roles, and his perspectives on the space industry, including the recent phenomenon of SPACs. I also got to hear some of his plans for Varda and how he sees in-space manufacturing evolving over the next few years. I've keenly followed Delian's journey over the years, starting from his passion for space, his interesting career spanning across cross-functional roles, and now ending up in the dream job of being a space tech entrepreneur. It was a pleasure to have him on my podcast, and I hope you enjoy this special episode. Before we get to it, just a small request. I'm looking for feedback from you, the listeners. It can be whether you're enjoying this podcast or not, if you have any suggestions on the format, questions, or maybe you have recommendations for guests. Just let me know on Twitter or LinkedIn. Now on to the episode. Sit back and enjoy. Hi, Delian. Thanks for taking the time.
Thanks so much for having me on. Excited to chat today.
Brilliant. So let's get started. The first question that I usually start with is to ask guests to describe their story. And you have a very peculiar story. And I think a lot of people, you know, follow you on Twitter, so they kind of know your story and, you know, overall. But it'd be good to know for those who don't know.
Yeah, I'll try and do the kind of brief life story. I was born in Bulgaria to two sort of Eastern European, very technical parents. Ended up coming out to the United States for their grad school. And, you know, sort of that was kind of what sparked the initial, let's say, you know, interest in space. You know, the Pathfinder mission launched like the week that I arrived in the United States. The landing was my first July 4th in the United States. And sort of super consistently with my parents, sort of, you know, watched all the various sort of NASA, you know, missions. Eventually even went out to NASA Ames Center back in 2012 and got to watch, the Curiosity, landing in that first time where they had the, you know, six minutes of terror. But yeah, I ended up going off to MIT, thought that I was going to basically, you know, go to, you know, JPL and, you know, work in space and robotics there as a, you know, PhD and eventually contribute to one of these missions. But kind of had this huge, you know, sort of aha moment summer of 2012 when I came out to Silicon Valley and had my first internship out of here and kind of realized that the world of, you know, startups was actually a much better way potentially to have an effect on the world and even in space. And so I ended up sort of taking a hard left turn, dropped out of school for the Thiel Fellowship, ended up founding a company, not in space, actually, in the sort of enterprise healthcare world. I sort of thought that, like, it wasn't possible to sort of do, you know, admittedly in 2012, that wasn't, you know, honestly that wrong of, like, couldn't really do a space company unless you, you know, were, like, a billionaire or had, you know, sold a company for a lot of money. And so thought that I kind of had to, you know, do normal tech first. Ended up running that company for about 3.5-4 years. It went okay, not amazing. We got to sort of like ramen profitability, but eventually sort of soft landed and shut down the company. And so for a year after that, I kind of took a break in some ways and was the VP of growth at this company called Teespring. And then now for the past 4 years, have been a venture capitalist. And the first half of that was at Coastal Ventures, and that was where I really discovered the idea that I could actually do space sooner rather than later. About 6-7 months into my time at Coastal Ventures, ended up sort of sourcing and funding this company called Akash Systems that does sort of next-generation satellite radios, and just kind of realized, I was like, oh, shit, like, I thought that I had to, like, keep doing kind of normal tech for a while, and space was this, like, super far-off thing, versus I kind of had this realization where I was like, whoa, I can actually start doing sort of space today. And so kind of doubled down on that, started going to all the various sort of space industry conferences, talking to lots more commercial space CEOs, sort of thinking about, okay, well, maybe one day, I would actually leave VC and go start a space company, and maybe I'm getting, you know, more ready to do that. And then I ended up coming over here to Founders Fund and discovering the world of sort of doing incubations and kind of realized that that was maybe the right way to actually do this, since, I've met a lot of really great CEOs, and I'm not sure that I'm the best CEO. I'm not necessarily as, you know, patient or as good of a people manager as some of the really good CEOs that I know. And so over the summer of sort of 2020, started exploring, you know, the idea that eventually turned into Varda, basically in space, manufacturing, that had partially just stemmed from, seeing a lot of companies back when I was sort of excited about space in 2010, 2011, 2012, when I was sort of in high school and college, and going out and meeting with a lot of those companies and kind of realizing that they sort of weren't doing space manufacturing in what I thought was sort of the correct way. And so didn't end up investing in them and kind of realized like, oh crap, like maybe this is the thing that I need to finally, incubate or go create, is space manufacturing, since I just don't want it to be, 5 years down the line, still sort of staring back and being like, well, all the space industry is still mostly focused on, Earth observation and communication, and nobody had really ever, done space manufacturing correctly. And so, yeah, that was kind of the motivation behind Varda. Kind of started it sort of, summer 2020, and then, met my, now, sort of co-founder and CEO, Will Brewey, at the sort of end of August, and same time as our sort of roughly the same time as our chief scientist, Daniel. I sort of spent the sort of fall working together. I ended up sort of raising our, seed round of $9 million over the course of sort of November, December that year, co-led by Founders Fund and Lux. And so now we're on, day, I think it's 51 of being in the office and having, everybody full time. I think we're up to, sort of 14 employees full time and 5 interns. So, 19 people over the course of, 48 days is not bad, I'd say, in terms of, team build out. It's about, a person every 3 days. So it's definitely been a hectic first, sprint at the company. But, turns out our CEO is a very, very good recruiter. And so that makes life a lot easier.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you share pictures of your photos, the company photos on Twitter. And I think, it's easy to, let's say, attract people in, and Twitter seems to be a nice medium for doing that. To go back in your life a little bit, so when did you decide you wanted to work in space? Because obviously your parents, come from the scientific world, and I don't know if they work in space directly, or of course you come into the US and where your exposure to space is more than if you'd have been in Eastern Europe. So was that the reason that kind of pushed you, or why are you passionate about space so much?
Yeah, it's hard to point to like one exact particular moment. I think it was something that was just like pervasive throughout my life. Everything from sci-fi books to movies to going to these various like NASA launches. There's maybe this moment in like 10th grade. So like my, mom is an economist and my dad's a sort of statistician, mathematician. And my dad actually won the International Math Olympiad when he was in high school and got a gold medal. And I think I had this moment maybe in like, 10th grade or so, where I kind of had this like aha, where I realized I was like, I'm never going to be as good at math as my dad is. And so I need to find the thing that like I'm really excited about and like, want to be very good at. And robotics ended up being the thing that I sort of wanted to, do and really double down on. And so I ended up sort of helping found my like high school, robotics team, ended up sort of being like the lead software engineer on that for quite some time. Ended up again, going off to MIT and thinking like, okay, robotics, space, that's where I'm going to like sort of really become, sort of world class. I don't know if there was like any one particular, moment that I can really point to in my life where I was like, oh, now I need to do space. I think it was something where it was just like, yeah, of course, like the whole point of doing like software and engineering and robotics is like to do space stuff. Cause like, what the hell else are we on this earth for? Since like seventh grade or something like that.
No, absolutely. I mean, it seems like you, at least for, for me looking at it from the outside, it seems like you kind of planned everything out. If I look at everything that you've done, it's like you founded your own company, you have some startup experience, and then you've been a VC. So, you know how the world of VC works, kind of network with people. And then now you go to your master plan, which is, to find the, found a space company. So it seems like it kind of worked out well over the years. I wanted to get into the your different roles that you've done. Obviously, you've been tracking developments in space over the years. And I've seen that on Twitter as well, that, you've been, let's say, an active advocate of what's going on in space and kind of spreading the word of what's going on in space tech. So How did you manage to do that, even though you've not been within the space world? You had your own portfolio companies that you're working with, or if you had your own startup, you were working with your own startup. How did you manage to, let's say, keep on track of everything that's going on?
Yeah, I mean, I will say this master plan looks obvious when you connect the dots in reverse, but it was not very obvious, like, throughout. Like, you know, I've talked about, you know, it was funny when I finally sort of announced, you know, the Varda fundraising round. It was funny just seeing all these sort of old friends come out of the woodwork that were like, oh, you finally did the thing that you, like, pitched me on. But, like, the people that would come out of the woodwork just kept being, like, further and further back. Like, I had somebody, like, that, like, I haven't seen since 2009 that was like, oh, you finally did the thing you pitched me on in 2009. I was like, I don't remember pitching somebody in 10th grade on, like, space manufacturing. But I guess I might. Like, yeah, I guess it's just been so pervasive throughout my life that I guess, like, it's something that I've been thinking about for a lot longer than I can, like, truly appreciate. And maybe subconsciously because of that, I kind of planned this whole career path. But I have to say, like, you know, it's you know, those are more instinctual along the way kind of decisions that were gut based, not really like with this like sort of clear, I don't know, not master plan. But I guess at some point, if you like keep thinking about idea and keep talking about an idea, it'll eventually sort of, you know, come to fruition. In relation to, like, you know, keeping up on space, yeah, I will say, you know, even as I was working on an enterprise healthcare company or, you know, when I was a VP of growth at Teespring, you know, I still really sort of, you know, kept a close pulse on sort of what the space industry was up to. Yeah, I can't say that it was, like, in a super, let's say, sophisticated way of just, like, I just followed all of the, like, major space reporters on Twitter. I was just, like, addicted to, like, r/space, r/SpaceX, r/Rocket Lab, and, like, would just read everything that ever came out about any company. I would watch every single launch. It was just, like, super obsessive, but, like, and, you know, would make sure to, like, for example, one of my, you know, friends from MIT ended up working at SpaceX. I would just, like, grab dinner with him every, like, 2 to 3 months and just, like, you know, learn about sort of what he was working on. So, you know, it's not like I, you know, and again, it was mostly just as like a passion. It wasn't because like I had this plan to like start a space company. It was just like, I fucking love this stuff. And like, I just want to, you know, constantly be up to date on it. And then it was only once I sort of invested in that first company, Akash Systems, was like, okay, like I've been like a space geek from afar, but like I need to like now learn like the business of space. Like this isn't, you know, some magical thing. Like there are real people with real businesses that make all of this stuff actually work. And so I need to go meet all of these people. And so I started going to all of the various like sort of space startup conferences and got to know everybody. And then, yeah, it turns out there's actually a pretty limited set of companies. If you look at companies that have basically raised, let's say, north of $15 million from venture capital that work on space, the number of companies is like 20, 25. Like, it's not really that many companies. Like, it's a pretty limited set. And so you can spend, you know, in some ways, just like a couple of conferences and you kind of get to know everybody. And then, you know, the way you can kind of think about business ideas is like, how does it fit in within this ecosystem? Because like, there's not that many different players or people to rely on or vendors to work with. And so you can kind of think about it in relation to these various, you know, different groups. You can kind of keep this entire, you know, people talk about like market maps of space. I'm like, it's very different than like the world of SaaS, where it's like, it's impossible to keep the world of SaaS in any one person's head. There's like so many companies. There's like with space, it's quite easy. Like I have everybody on speed dial in some ways, you know, that works in space. It's very, you know, collaborative because it's such a small community. So, yeah, that's kind of how I, you know, kept up with it as a space geek from afar and then sort of got more serious about it professionally in like, you know, summer of 2017.
Got it. And why do you think we are hearing so much about space these days? Like, what has changed? Because it seems like it's been in the news so much more than it's ever been. And do you think it's because of SpaceX? Is it because we are starting to do a lot more things? And, you know, obviously, it helps because that's kind of the world you come in. You didn't come into a world in 2005 when this was, you know, not talked about as much. What's going on today that, you know, has changed?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think as much as some people may, you know, harp on the last administration for, you know, a variety of different reasons, I think one area that they were extremely strong on was the space industry. You know, Jim Bridenstine and Mike Pence, former NASA administrator and obviously our former vice president, honestly did a really phenomenal job of just like driving resources towards the commercialization of space. It was a significant accelerant, you know, relative to sort of prior administrations that tried to mostly do things, you know, in-house. And they kicked off a flywheel that, you know, has made incredible progress over the past, you know, 4 years. I do think a lot of the reason why is because now you're seeing, you know, just the ability for commercial companies to like market what they're doing and like, you know, to make it feel cool is just like significantly higher than like NASA. I mean, NASA is like a decent, you know, marketing program. They do a great job, but just like, I don't know if you saw like, you know, you know, the Rocket Lab CEO's like announcement of his like new rocket was just like, it was hilarious. You know what I mean? You're never going to see a video like that, you know, from like a NASA administrator. They have to be more buttoned up. They're like a government agency. They can't release these kind of like, you know, crazy videos. And so I think part of it is just like, yeah, it turns out when you make things commercial, people are willing to market it a lot more. And then also, yeah, just like the hardware is pretty fucking exciting. Like, because, you know, I had this, you know, sort of space investor friend that used to say, you know, at conferences that like, you know, the only, you know, liquidity events in all of space history, was, you know, Skybox back in 2009, getting bought by Google. And obviously that's changed a lot, you know, since, you know, she used to say that, you know, pretty regularly 2 or 3 years ago. And so there's a lot more sort of, you know, investor interest now that they're seeing sort of the light at the end of the tunnel, and especially now with the, you know, valuations that SpaceX is trading at. And so investors are much more interested in driving a lot more capital into it because of the actual like financial outcomes. And then the actual, and because of that, the like hardware just looks a lot cooler. I'm just like, I think one of the things that people sort of don't appreciate is like SpaceX has raised more money in the past sort of, you know, let's say now 22 months than they did over the prior decade combined. And so it's like, if you think SpaceX has done cool things over the past decade, let me tell you what they could do now with like, you know, a lot, many more billions sort of on their, you know, balance sheet. And it's something that like, you know, Elon has actually had to like force his team to think differently about, right? Like, you know, he I have a friend that is, you know, still a skip level to, you know, Elon at SpaceX working on Starship. And he talks about how all the time Elon in meetings is basically like, you guys need to stop being worried about rockets blowing up. Like, I get for most of the, you know, company's lifetime, a rocket blowing up on the pad was basically the death knell of the company. But Elon's like, I have infinite money now. I don't care about rockets blowing up. All I care about is how quickly you can move. And so it's amazing to see that obviously now with Starship, of like the Starship development program is wildly different than how like we've done rocket development basically since like the 60s. Like in the 60s, we did used to let rockets blow up a lot. We spent a lot of money, but that was because, yeah, the budgets were really big because the government was spending so much, you know, of our GDP on it, versus like since then it's become much more conservative. And so for the first time, sort of capital feels infinite sort of in space again. It's not truly obviously infinite for most people. You know, SpaceX is really, you know, the only one. Maybe now Rocket Lab has, you know, significant, you know, amounts of capital on its balance sheet, but there is just starting to be a lot more interest in spending true amounts of dollars, R&D dollars on space, because investors are now seeing the return on those R&D dollars in very, very big ways. It turns out, like, when you expand the market size to things that are just no longer just terrestrial, turns out that's a lot of fucking money, and investors like making money.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it's I want to then go back to SPACs, because you mentioned all the investor interest. Maybe they are trying to, let's say, bounce off of what's going on with SpaceX, but it seems like, you know, there's a lot going on with SPACs and the valuations, and there have been 7 SPACs so far, I think, just including Virgin Galactic, and 6 since last October. In the space industry, I would say that's a lot for an industry that's just starting to become commercialized, to have the potential for 6 exits. They have not, you know, closed yet. But what's your perspective on SPACs? And, you know, would you also look at a SPAC in, you know, a few years?
Yeah, I think, you know, this is sort of most sophisticated argument that I, you know, heard about this from a sort of friend that's very smart in the public equities field. He runs his own hedge fund, is, if you look at the, you know, majority of returns over the past decade, the people who made the most money in public equities were the people that bought Amazon in 2010 and then just didn't fucking sell. That's it. You could have done anything else, like, you know, tons of other strategies, et cetera. You wouldn't have matched just the IRR of just buying buying Amazon in 2010 and just holding. It's sort of now equivalently true in, you know, SpaceX as well, where it's like, if you bought SpaceX in 2010 and just held, you made a lot of fucking money, including obviously, you know, Founders Fund, we're one of the largest shareholders of SpaceX, and we're very happy to have bought a lot of SpaceX stock in 2009 and 2010 and have never sold. And so now when, you know, sort of public investors are thinking about valuing companies, they do think about things a little bit differently. The way that this, you know, sort of hedge fund friend of mine describes it, he's like, the way that he thinks about companies now is not like, what is their, you know, underlying revenue multiple, you know, how should they value their EBITDA? He does put in a factor in there that's like, what is the percentage chance that this turns out to be the next Amazon over the next decade? And his willingness to sort of pay up a lot is significantly changed by that. And so I think beyond just, let's say, space specifically, you're obviously seeing, SPACs accelerating, across the entire sort of tech ecosystem and companies going, public much earlier because there's just so much retail demand for the types of returns that in some ways just like late stage tech investors have had a, stranglehold over that have been incredibly successful. I mean, like the sort of pre-IPO or, two rounds before IPO, like tech investments are just phenomenal. I mean, like for sure, SoftBank got a lot of shit over the past, let's say, 3 or 4 years for the returns. But like then they had DoorDash hit and then it was like, well, doesn't matter. Like that made up the returns for all of the ones that like didn't work out. You can make fun of them for WeWork, you can make fun of them for everything else, but like you add up, DoorDash plus Opendoor and like turns out that's great returns. And so people are starting to realize that that was sort of an arbitrage that is now starting to get closed by these companies going public earlier and earlier. So coming to the world of space, it's a lot of SPACs. Some of these companies don't, necessarily have fundamentals that I think can justify those valuations. And so the way that they're justified is the percentage chance that these companies turn out to be SpaceX. If you take those six SPACs that have happened sort of over the past, 4 or 5 months, and you were to allocate and tell me, okay, do you think there's like a, for each of these, do they, does each of them have at least a 1/6 chance to become the next SpaceX, right? Such that if I needed to invest $1 billion and I allocated equally across all six, is there 1/6 chance that one of them turns out to be SpaceX? In which case, doesn't fucking matter because like I'm investing at an average $3 billion valuation. SpaceX trades at 70 now. And so obviously it's like way north of a 6x, multiple on that. So it turns out that'll be a great fund. It'll be a 2 to 3x return on, $1 billion, which many investors would be happy with. I'd say, there's like a decent shot, right? I mean, honestly, out of all of those, probably the one that I'm sort of most enthusiastic about is probably Rocket Lab, right? They've actually, sent hardware up. They, I think have a great, development plan. They've clearly shown ability to sort of mass manufacture, maintain operational consistency. They're making like real revenues. There's like real fundamentals there. Another one that I'm a pretty big fan of is Spire, which, just announced that they're, going to SPAC. Spire, phenomenal company in some ways. Honestly, I have to say it wasn't the one that I necessarily thought was going to work in the grand scheme of, space companies 3 or 4 years ago when, first sort of heard about them. But they've done a really great job of just like, maybe you can quip on their satellite hardware not being like the best hardware, the most innovative, et cetera, but they've continued to steadily march and improve their hardware over time and at the same time have developed their customer base. And their customer base, they're not like, they're not space company. You know what I mean? Like with SpaceX, at least it's like, oh, like, well, like if the space bubble burst, then like a lot less people are going to buy launch. But like for Spire, like their company or their customers are just like insurance companies and like, the federal government and like, just groups that don't care anything about the fact that they're like a space company. And so, would I assign a greater than 1/6 probability to like Rocket Lab and Spire, to becoming the next like, SpaceX or, i.e. like, north of a $10 billion valuation? Like, yeah, I think they have, a solid shot of that. Now, as you start to go down the list of like the rest of the SPACs, I start to get a little bit more skeptical, right? But that maybe that doesn't necessarily matter because like in a portfolio of bets, that's fine. And retail investors are getting more accustomed to the idea of just like having a portfolio of sort of more venture risk type bets. Now, you're for the question of like, would Varda SPAC? Obviously, we got started 3 months ago, so it's a little bit, premature to be considering this. But yeah, at the end of the day, my job is sort of chairman of the board and, thinking about, sort of how one navigates, financing ecosystems. Companies like Varda, do have significant advantages when they have access to large pools of capital. And in comparison to a lot of these companies that are SPACing, I also think that we have much sort of near-term potential revenues for the, products and materials that we're manufacturing up there. And so I do think, you can start to justify sort of, taking on large amounts of capital and, justifying the valuations that the public markets expect. And the upside being, potentially sort of quite large. So yeah, definitely not, a door that we're, considering opening right now. And if the sort of, environment sort of stays where as is over the course of the next couple of years, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if that's something that, we pretty seriously consider since there's just so much retail demand for these types of assets. And there's just not that many, sort of high quality assets that are out there. And so I think we could potentially attract a lot of, demand because of that.
Absolutely, yeah, definitely. I'll come to Varda in a bit and, let you explain what kind of problem you're trying to address and, the addressable market that it potentially has, which, which is huge. I wanted to get back to your, let's say, your perspectives on how you see the space industry, because obviously there's, like you mentioned, there are these standard companies, the Earth observation companies and the launchers and communications, but again, with SpaceX and Starlink, I don't think we can not stop talking about them. But it seems like, you know, there are different companies out there in different technologies, let's say different space domains. Where do you see the success in the short term? Because obviously there's been some questions over space tourism and Virgin Galactic and what's going on there. And Blue Origin obviously has been talking about it a lot and they haven't, you know, done it yet. There's again SpaceX once again into that mix with space tourists. So space tourism is, you know, a different kind of market. And then there's the traditional satellite IoT and satellite internet and Earth observation type of companies. How do you see the market generally and where do you see the success in the short term?
Yeah, I mean, there's a significant, let's say, like subset of the market that I just like categorize as like science fiction and a complete sort of waste of, you know, investor, you know, capital. You know, as an example, like private space tourism, sending astronauts up to the, like, you know, ISS that, you know, pay their own way. It's like, it's a extremely small market. You know, the number of people that can pay, you know, $20 to $30 million for a ticket to go up to the ISS for like a week, and that's like if people optimize the shit out of the economics, right? It's like almost certainly, you know, going to be north of that, you know, for ticket sales. It's just like a very, very, very constrained and small market, right? Like we're talking about, you know, tens to hundreds of individuals that can do this. And sure, if you add that up, it ends up being like some amount of revenue, but like these people aren't going to do that every year. Like this is not some like very consistent revenue base. Like, you know, the billionaires are not going to spend $200 million every single year going to space. They might do it once. They're not going to do it every single year. It's the world of like space tourism to me just makes no sense and it's like way too far out and it's not something that like investors are going to see returns from. Same thing with like asteroid mining, lunar ice mining. Like in order to make real returns in space and like, you know, move the industry forward, you need to focus on things that are like near term commercially viable, right? And at scale, right? This can't be like, you know, some niche thing. Because like even if you look at space tourism, like the economics of like, you know, Dragon plus the ISS, it's not like those things are like, there's not some like decaying cost curve, right? Like the Crew Dragon needs to be over-engineered and as expensive as it is so that it is like human rated. Like that's not getting cheaper. The ISS is also not getting cheaper anytime soon. If anything, it's like getting more expensive. I mean, you're starting to see this, right? With like NASA, you know, actually increasing the prices of sending things to the ISS. And so it's just like, why would you be focused on a business model where prices are increasing when like the infrastructure costs of all the rest of space are decreasing if you just focus on something that's like more, you know, sort of commercially viable. So we can bucket all those companies extremely bearish on. Then within the world of, let's say, like, you know, true sort of near-term commercial space industry, there's basically like a handful of different, you know, types of companies. There's Earth observation and, you know, you have a variety of different, let's say, frequencies across the spectrum. We started off with visual, people started to introduce radar. Now people are starting to think about like infrared. At the end of the day, these companies are just, you know, computers that have a camera on it that points itself at Earth. That's it. They're all the same. It's interesting. I think it's difficult to have a very differentiated approach there. Even as I said, I'm, you know, bullish on Spire. They're going to have some real difficulties. They're really going to have to build up extreme operational efficiencies. Like in some ways, they're like closer to a DoorDash in that like they're going to have a lot of competition. It's going to be like, you know, very, you know, sort of thin margins. And there's going to be a lot of people sort of nipping at their heels. And as they're going up to these markets, the market prices that people are willing to pay are actually like decreasing over time. So for sure, they're like expanding the supply of like there's going to be a lot more photos of the Earth. But like even the ESA right now, you know, for like radar images of various parts of Europe, they're actually like how the cost curve is actually decaying of like how much ESA is willing to pay for these various like radar scans. And so it's definitely a difficult spot to be in, but for sure, you know, economies of scale, getting really good at manufacturing, continuing to improve, you know, your software and your sensors, you know, can provide you some, let's say, temporary advantages, but I think you have to spin that ideally into an act two eventually. Communications, there's going to be, you know, Starlink is clearly off into the races. You know, we just doubled down and invested, you know, in SpaceX from Founders Fund. And so we're obviously, you know, bullish on the opportunity there. There's for sure going to be some challenges. They continue to sort of maintain their network, expand connection, bandwidth, you know, the consumers that they go after. But I think, you know, that should be a relatively real market. In the grand scheme of total, you know, broadband internet, you know, even if Starlink captures, you know, 0.5% of the market, that's still a great outcome, you know, for Elon and Starlink. And so it'd be great to see that. I think there's going to be a lot more, you know, sort of communication satellite constellations, in particular around things that maybe aren't necessarily directly broadband consumer, you know, the economics of like, you know, sort of backhaul, especially to sort of, you know, remote areas where, you know, maybe laying fiber is a little bit difficult. I think there's going to be, you know, constellations that form around that. Those are sort of like obviously the major, like, let's say, like, you know, satellite operator types. So that's how I bucket, you know, both, you know, observation and communications. And then there's just sort of the whole supply chain that sort of is like largely focused on enabling those, right? So you have the launch market. I think it's going to be like really hard beyond just basically, let's say, like SpaceX, Rocket Lab. There's maybe going to be one or two more players after that. But I think it's going to look like, you know, SpaseX is going to, you know, capture 60 to 70% of the total enterprise value in that market. You can have, you know, something like Rocket Lab probably doing 10 to 15, you know, Blue Origin or something like that doing like 10%, and then maybe one other group doing 5%. And I think after that, it's going to be a really steep drop off. And so I don't totally understand the companies that are like starting today in like 2021 doing new launchers. Like, I think you're just like almost like a, you know, 5 years at minimum too late to a market that is like extremely mature, and your ability to like compete on a cost basis against, you know, these very mature groups, I think gonna be really tough. And so I think very mature market, unlikely to, I think, shift in terms of, you know, winners. The next step down are the very sort of you know, vendors for the both manufacturing of satellites and then particular parts of satellites. That's an area that I get, you know, really excited about. So let's call the one area the sort of like satellite integrators is what I like to call them, or the bus manufacturers. So you have everything from, you know, Blue Canyon, which just got bought by, you know, I believe Raytheon or Lockheed. I'm forgetting which one. I think Raytheon. You have Raytheon, right? Yeah. You have up and coming companies like York Space Systems, you know, Loft Orbital. You know, there's a couple that are obviously, you know, older school, like Millennial Systems, owned by Boeing. But there's this whole group of basically like, we are trying to sort of now start to quote unquote, like mass manufacture, you know, satellites and make them a little bit more, off the shelf. I definitely get excited about those, you know, companies. Again, how much sort of enterprise value is there going to be there? You know, maybe not entirely clear, but it's really exciting to see this stuff start to become, you know, people talk about space hardware getting more off the shelf. It's still not really. Like, even with Varda, we talk about like, you know, hey, our first, you know, mission is going to have some quote unquote off the shelf hardware. Not really. At least for the first time, we don't have to build the satellite ourselves in-house, but like we're doing it out of house, and like it's not really off the shelf. Like, it's still custom made. It's just like custom made on a more regular basis. Eventually it'd be amazing if I can go to a factory and literally be like, I want that satellite, and I can literally buy it off the shelf. We're still probably at least like 2 to 3 years away from that, but I'm really excited about that market. The other area that I get, you know, really excited about is like the underlying like vendors of a particular component. So Akash Systems is an example of this, right? Of they sort of make the best satellite radios on Earth. They have the best efficiencies, the best, you know, sort of total bandwidth you can pump through them. And so I think it's great to be an arms dealer in this market where, you know, people are willing to pay up a lot for their radio because it's so much better. If you're spending whatever, you know, $4 million to get a satellite up into space, if you have a radio that can 2x or 3x your bandwidth, you're going to be very willing to spend, let's say, $400,000 on that radio. And that provides, you know, a lot of margin, you know, for something like Akash Systems. So if you're in that sort of step in a value chain, you have a very differentiated product that has extreme performance improvements, I think that can be great. So that's a more mature investment that I've made in that space. A more nascent investment that I more recently made, it's called MagDrive. It's in this sort of small sat propulsion space. Again, it's a particular component that's very important to satellites, being able to move your satellite around. Typically has only been done in, you know, two ways. So you either have one, what I call sort of high thrust systems, but very low efficiencies, typically, you know, cold gas thrusters are what are used in sort of small satellites. Or on the other end, you have very low thrust. So I mean, you can't move very quickly, but very high efficiencies in electric propulsion, you know, Hall thrusters, things like that. Both sort of systems come with their downsides. With high thrust, low efficiency, you can move quickly, but you can't get very far. With, you know, sort of low thrust but high efficiency, you can get very far. You can get to fucking Pluto if you want, but it's going to take you like, you know, 17 years. And so both come with their downsides of like, you know, if you're an operator like Spire, you know, it's kind of a pain in the ass because you either have to make your satellite big in order to get it quickly where it needs to go, or you have to just wait a long time. You end up losing like 6 months of the satellite's lifetime just, you know, getting it to its eventual sort of parking orbit. MagDrive is a company that is working on a piece of small sat propulsion technology that combines the best of both worlds, where you both have very high thrust, but then also incredibly high impulse, i.e. High efficiency thrust. And so, you know, nascent, you know, piece of technology, but would be an example similar to Akash Systems, where because it's such a differentiated, you know, performer in comparison to sort of what's on the market, they should be able to sort of command high margin. Because again, if Spire, if you can now go to Spire and be like, hey, you can still keep your satellite pretty small, but I can get you to your parking orbit in 2 weeks. That's obviously, you know, potentially if their lifetime of their satellites is, you know, 2 years and they're wasting, and let's say that satellite generates $10 million of revenue and you're wasting a quarter of that lifetime just getting to the parking orbit. Okay, well, now you're talking about a potential increase of revenue of like, you know, $2.5 million. Your willingness to spend $500K of that increase in revenue on this, you know, propulsion system is, you know, quite high. And so That's another area that I get excited about. One area that I'm like paying attention to, but haven't necessarily found a company that I want to back is sort of mass manufacturing of space-based, you know, solar panels. You know, the way that I think about it is like you can sort of break down a satellite in each individual component, and I ideally want to sort of invest in the company that is sort of doing the next generation of each of those. There's not a clear sort of player yet, so if anybody hears this and has, you know, space-based solar panel companies that they're working on, excited to chat with. And similar with all the various other components, you know, batteries, you know, solar panels, you know, flight computers, things like that. Definitely excited to, you know, see if anybody has super interesting and differentiated approaches to those various components that we could potentially invest in. So that's the other area that I sort of get excited by. And so, yeah, those are basically all the space companies. I mean, there's like now a sub-segment that's kind of like the like data analytics aggregators, you know, that we can talk about. But those are more like space software than they are like space. And to me, not necessarily, you know, as interesting, but can go, you know, maybe I'll skip over analyzing those. But yeah, that was probably, you know, quite the ramp. But as you can tell, I've been thinking about the space industry for quite some time.
No, definitely. I mean, it seems like you have kind of the whole ecosystem in your head figured out. And obviously, you know, you need to do that in order to kind of understand the supply chain for Varda. And now let's get to Varda and, you know, let the listeners know what Varda is about, because I think from the title of the episode, they're probably going to know it's about, you know, manufacturing something in orbit, potentially optical fiber cables or something like that, because I'm sure they would have Googled or at least heard about what Varda is about. So let's say, sell us on that idea of, you know, what the problem that you're trying to solve.
Yeah, the simplest way, you know, to describe it actually comes from one of our lead investors, Josh Wolf, over at Lux, and I like his framing a lot, which is basically there are a variety of different products that are very valuable, increase the quality of life for people here on Earth, that can only be manufactured inside of a microgravity environment. And obviously the only way to simulate microgravity, we have no way of doing that on Earth today. If we did, we'd be manipulating space-time and making, you know, wormholes and warp drives and stuff like that. So we're a little ways away from that, is to go to space. And so we're basically making those types of products. We're not yet technically commenting on what we're, you know, manufacturing in our first mission publicly, but, you know, with a physics degree, and if you crawl around our LinkedIn page, I'm sure you can figure it out. So the way that I like to frame it is like we're doing space manufacturing, but there's sort of like two types of space manufacturing. We're not doing space manufacturing for use in space. There's a lot of companies that are, you know, trying to do that, but I think that's a much sort of further out and closer to sci-fi market. We're doing space manufacturing for Earth. And so we're taking basically raw materials, taking them up into space, fabricating them into a product that is only possible to be made in that microgravity environment, and then basically bringing them back down. And so for our first, you know, handful of products, you know, we're both, you know, sort of developing the product in-house ourselves and finding the customers for it and doing the actual sort of space logistics. Over time, the goal is to be what we call the sort of contract manufacturer for space, where eventually we approach external companies and say, hey, you have a product that we know would have significant benefit from being done in space. Let us insert ourselves into your supply chain and act as a contract manufacturer. Take your raw materials. We'll take them up to space. We know how to fabricate them for you in the way that you like it, and then basically send them back to you. There are a variety of different products that have been studied on the International Space Station already that have shown significant benefit for this. And so the science has already been relatively de-risked. There's everything from, you know, semiconductors, human organs, cancer drugs, as you mentioned, fiber optic cables, that have already been significantly studied, but nobody's really taken those sort of science research projects, let's say, and tried to significantly commercialize them. So that was sort of how Varda originally started. Was I took a look at the various sort of companies and research groups that were working on this type of microgravity manufacturing and realized that there are sort of two sort of major, you know, faults with their strategy. The first was most of these companies were more focused on the research of these materials as opposed to the commercialization of these materials. So for example, you know, semiconductors, yeah, you can like go quickly do an experiment that shows, hey, there's benefit, but that's very different than like then producing materials that like commercial customers actually want to buy. And like nobody's really focused on sort of that second, very, very difficult problem for what it's worth of, you know, commercializing materials. And we have some really great material scientists on our teams that have, you know, sort of commercialized, you know, these types of very, you know, high value materials before, and, you know, can go on length as to why these problems are so difficult. And then the second that's somewhat, you know, even more important and more, you know, has turned out to be, you know, more cogent, you know, today, especially as, you know, NASA's released some, you know, news about the International Space Station, is being independent of NASA and the International Space Station. Like, in what world would you want when, like, all of a sudden, you know, rocket costs are massively decreasing, everything's becoming so much cheaper in space, to then have a part of your company reliant on an extremely expensive, bureaucratic research organization that moves incredibly slowly. Like, the International Space Station is never going to be a place where large-scale commercial manufacturing happens. And if you're reliant on them to do so, then your ability to succeed as a company is completely fraught, because you need to be able to do this independently and quickly. And so the other main thing that we're doing is basically doing this type of microgravity manufacturing, but independent of the International Space Station, in what I call basically a free-flying space factory. And so those are sort of the two major things that we're focused on, is one, basically developing these in-house materials, two, doing this free-flying space factory, over time basically scaling up those, you know, supply chains and revenues for these materials, and then eventually basically making it so that we're more like a contract manufacturer, where it's not just our own in-house materials we're working on, but also partnering with external companies. And so that's a kind of, you know, brief pitch, but happy to dive into any more of that. But there's some stuff that we're not yet commenting on publicly, but this isn't also a company that we'll be not commenting on publicly for forever. It's just, wait for, around October, November, we'll talk about, sort of what we're doing, very transparently and publicly. But I just don't like to sort of overpromise and underdeliver.
Absolutely.
Deliver what we're actually going to do. And so I like just showing what we're doing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I wanted to, I'll wait for, let's say, what you're going to do. I'm curious about, like, why hasn't anybody, tried to do this? It's just baffling. I mean, maybe it makes sense because, as an outsider within the space industry, I see that in the space industry, there's a lot of focus on R&D, and people get excited about the R&D a lot. And, they have not focused on the commercialization part as much. And it seems like that's kind of what you've figured out, in terms of, you can even call it, that's what they call new space. They thought new space is all about, commercial and private. But like you mentioned, most of them have contracts with NASA, and that's their revenue flow. But it seems like you're kind of trying to actually do what new space is about and trying to commercialize. So is that kind of why you started? Because you saw that there's, so much R&D work going on, but it's not been commercialized. Was that the motivation?
Yeah, that's definitely part of it. I mean, it was this interesting thing where I had the idea for Varda, and I just kept pitching it to various experts in microgravity manufacturing. I was like, isn't this the correct long-term strategy in order to commercialize it? And everybody's like, yes. And I'm like, okay, well, why is nobody doing it? They're like, well, because it's difficult. And I was like, but you agree that it's not impossible. It's very doable. If you got the right team together and the right funding and you did this, you're like, oh yeah, of course. You should do it. And I'm like, okay, but why hasn't anybody done it? I never really got a good answer. That was in some ways sort of what gave me confidence, to go and do Varda, was if somebody came to me with here's this laws of physics or economics or, material science reason why this type of thing is inviable, then I would have been more hesitant. But everybody that I talked to, even sort of pseudo competitors in some ways, were like, great, we would love for you to do this, because then you prove out that it's possible to be done, and maybe we'll be able to benefit from that somehow. So yeah, no clear reason why, and for sure a part of that is the over focus on quote unquote R&D in the space industry. Varda is not an R&D company. We are not fundamentally pushing basic research. We are just integrating things that have already been invented and making it commercially viable. We are taking on as little sort of scientific and technical risk as is possible.
Definitely. I mean, it seems like that is kind of the way to go in space, and that's kind of what people used to do with software companies, and not worry about the working on the R&D side of things and just trying to make a product out of it. And it seems like that's what you're trying to do. But what would be curious to understand is, getting things up makes sense because launch costs are coming down, and like you mentioned, there are far too many launch companies. So even if 149 of them fail, there is one more remaining. So I think there's, from a getting it up there, it makes sense. So what's your, or maybe you wouldn't want to talk about it, do you already have ideas of how you want to get it down? Is that also something that you would do in your first mission, or is that the news that you'd have to wait until October?
Yeah, apologies. I'm not gonna comment yet on that publicly, but there will be some more information that comes out sort of in the October, November timeframe. But what I'll say is, it's important to be able to do this, fully end-to-end, commercially, independently.
Yeah.
And, if you crawl around through our, sort of LinkedIn, I'm sure you can figure out sort of why we built the sort of structure of the team that we have. But yeah, not yet something that we're commenting on publicly. But again, not because I want to become sort of stealth company that doesn't talk about what they're doing for 3 years and raises $500 million and fails because the tech never worked. It's mostly, I like to just be able to show off, and we'll have some cool stuff to basically show off in October, November, that will be sort of very similar to what will be going up in our first flight.
Yeah, no, that's perfectly fine. I mean, I'm just taking a listener's perspective because, you know, you're pitching the idea of a, you know, free-flying space factory. And, you know, as someone who kind of understands and who is, you know, a little smart, they're like, okay, launch costs are coming down. So you want to send it up and you want to build something there. Like like they build the International Space Station, you're probably going to build a space factory. And, you know, the question arises, like, how do you bring it down? And, you know, what happens to the stuff that, brings it down? And maybe someone, you know, listening is also part of that, let's say the supply chain that you're targeting, like, hey, we can make your material. So it'll be exciting to find out what happens there. And I was curious, so if you're the ones doing it, do you expect more Vardas to come up? Maybe, you know, after November, October, when, you know, people start figuring out, like, hey, so this is what you're doing. And you know what, we are in India, or we are in China, or, you know, we are in Europe, we're going to do the same thing. Do you see that happening? Do you see that as a threat, or do you want that to happen?
No, yeah, there's actually, you know, already sort of a handful of companies, including some that I sort of talked to as a part of, you know, potentially considering investing in a company as opposed to incubating. So there's some companies in the US, there's a company in the UK. They sort of have, like, you know, similar ambitions, let's say, to, you know, Varda, and more similar, like, technical approaches. I'd say the technical problems that we're solving are quite hard. And, you know, sort of getting vehicles up and getting vehicles down is something that, like, only one group has ever done before, i.e. SpaceX. And so I think, you know, without a team of that caliber, it's just, like, hard. It's a really hard problem. And so, yeah, it's cool. It's cool to see other companies sort of do it. I think it's unlikely that their sort of missions will end up being that successful. And so I'm not, like, particularly worried. Like, the reason that Varda is going to die is not because of, like, you know, homicide. It's almost certainly going to be suicide. And so, you know, if we pull it off, our sort of, like, first mover advantages and scale advantages are going to be so great that even if somebody does manage to pull it off after us, it's just going to be unlikely that they are able to sort of catch up with the caliber of team that we've put together.
Absolutely, yeah. And it seems like that's kind of first mover advantage is kind of, you know, the perfect example of describing Varda's positioning. And do you then see, you know, in-space manufacturing becoming the next, let's say, unicorn status, let's say in 5 years, 10 years, I don't know if you have a time frame that you're looking at, let's say, becoming commercial. Do you then see that as the next big thing in space? Because obviously, you know, making things for use in space is kind of, you know, long, long way ahead. Companies are starting to do that, but a market for that is probably not going to exist. So you think that the addressable market is going to become, you know, big enough that, you know, you or, you know, other Vardas coming up will have the potential to become unicorns? Because at the end of the day, you're creating a market for use on Earth. So, you know, you have a big market. It's not, you don't have to imagine it. You can see the market.
Yeah, that's part of why I sort of get excited, you know, every day to, you know, wake up and work on Varda, is because of these sort of, you know, trickle down effects that, you know, Varda being successful has, right? Like, when I talked about some of these markets around asteroid mining or lunar ice mining sort of being science fiction and not commercially viable today, that's true today. But if Varda is successful, it brings in a lot of these things that are now much more commercially viable. Like, if Varda is very successful and we have large scale space factories operating in orbit, my willingness then as an investor to underwrite investing in an asteroid company increases significantly, because now all of a sudden there's somebody that is actually a consumer or a customer of those raw materials in orbit. And so, yeah, I think it's, you know, incredibly important that Varda focuses on these near-term, very large scale commercial markets. But what I get really excited by in some ways is the, yeah, trickle down effects of what happens when Varda is successful. And so, yeah, I think, you know, I think the timeframes that we're talking about are not crazy, right? Like, you know, we will be flying, you know, our first mission roughly 2 years from today. We believe in that first mission, and in the first handful that we do, we'll actually be able to do sort of real levels of revenue. And so we're not talking about something that's like, you know, first revenues hitting in like, you know, 5+ years. Like, we think we can sort of make our first revenues within 2 to 3 years of founding the company. Yeah, that are actually, you know, related to the actual things that we're manufacturing, for sure. That might be like, you know, nearer term, you know, grants and R&D and things like that. But, you know, actual sort of real revenues based off the materials that the factory is producing are not that far away. And if that works, that'll definitely be a sort of big 0-to-1 moment where it's like, now all of a sudden the way to monetize space isn't just by sending, you know, photons down, i.e., you know, radio waves or communication for, you know, via, you know, Earth observation comms constellations, but all of a sudden you can make money in space by sending atoms up and down. And so if that works, you know, it just completely changes the game of, like, you know, Varda will then be, you know, consuming, you know, a Starship launch every week of raw materials that we're sending up and down to our factory. And so all of a sudden when there's that level of launch volume going up and down, that has a lot of awesome effects on the space economy as well that I get really excited by.
No, absolutely. I mean, it seems like there's a lot of work that you have yet to do, and but once it's done, it seems like there's going to be a perfect advocate for what's going to happen in the space industry. And I always think about, you know, these people who question why we need to invest in space. And I think if, you know, whenever Varda gets, let's say, the first product down and, you know, let's use it, maybe people will not see that being used. Maybe it's going to be somewhere in the background. And but at least you'll have, let's say, a value proposition that, you know, that's direct, that's explicit, that people can see, instead of, you know, oh, you know what, you use a weather app that actually uses space data. But I wanted to get into, you know, that part and ask you, do you think that we need to get more people excited about space, or you think there are enough? You know, it can be professionals, it can be VCs. Are there enough people excited about space? Should we make, you know, an effort to make it more exciting?
Yeah, in relation to, like, sort of your first, you know, comment there, you know, the thing that I sometimes like about Varda is, like, most of our, you know, end customers, they have no clue we're a space company. They have no interest in the fact that we're a space company. Like, we just are bringing them materials that are better than anything that they've seen on Earth before, because they weren't made on Earth and they're not possible to make on Earth, right? And, you know, there will be a, you know, strong value proposition for those customers. And yeah, they're going to want our products, and it's going to have nothing to do with the fact that we're a space company, right? And so that's sometimes why I get so excited by companies like Spire, is, again, their customers don't care about them being a space company. They just deliver a really important value proposition to them that just happens to come, you know, from something that's being, you know, sort of photographed in space. Yeah, in relation to sort of getting more people excited about space, for sure. You know, I think one thing that gets me, you know, sort of excited is seeing sort of the worlds of sort of Silicon Valley and aerospace start to become, you know, more closely tied. Like, I feel like for a long time, those were sort of two sort of separate and different worlds. There wasn't that many sort of, let's say, software engineers that are interested in space. There weren't that many VCs that were interested in space, versus it feels like now that is, you know, starting to, you know, sort of really meaningfully shift. And I think, you know, by continuing to sort of, you know, talk about these various companies, show that there's real returns in these companies, you know, continue to inform people about what sort of the potential market areas are, that sort of, you know, increases, you know, the number of sort of professionals that want to take space seriously, as opposed to just, you know, think of it as kind of like a, you know, side, you know, hobby or just kind of exciting thing, but not something that they would ever invest in. And so, yeah, definitely something that I get, you know, excited about, you know, seeing happen. And, you know, always, that's part of why I like to be, you know, so vocal on Twitter and come on all these podcasts, is to, you know, try and inspire more people to realize that they can actually take sort of space as a career, you know, more seriously, you know, sooner rather than later.
Yeah, no. And, you know, building on that, it seems like you're trying to make space tech the new software. And, you know, I think, you know, software is going to eat the world was, you know, once the saying, and it's, you know, still being true in a lot of countries. And it seems like what Varda is trying to do is trying to make space tech eat the world, or, you know, be part of the world and not recognize that, you know, space tech was part of that world. But it's exciting to, you know, look at that future. I don't want to get pessimistic, but do you think that something could go wrong in the next decade or so, like come 2030? Like, what is the world that you don't want to be living in? You know, of course, I hope that by that time we kind of get up raw materials and Varda space factories are bringing down a lot of stuff. So that's a nice world to imagine. But come 2030, what do you think shouldn't happen or shouldn't have had happened?
Yeah, I mean, large, you know, macroeconomic shocks can always cause a major regression, right? Like, you know, if all of a sudden, you know, we wake up tomorrow, the S&P 500 has, like, you know, gone down by 80%. You know, it causes the sort of, you know, investor capital to flee the market, especially, you know, sort of, you know, space companies will probably be amongst the first to go, given that, like, it's just more difficult to imagine sort of near-term returns from some of these companies, since unlike, you know, a software startup, you're not going to be making revenue in year one. And so if that all of a sudden causes the market to pull back, that drastically changes the sort of, like, you know, launch market, because all of a sudden now you don't have as many satellites going up. So that decreases the ability for companies like SpaceX to make money. And if that all of a sudden causes their, you know, stock price to absolutely tank, like, for sure, these things are very, you know, reflexive. And so it would be unfortunate to be in a world where in 2030 we actually just didn't make, you know, progress over the next decade because we, you know, experienced this type of macro shock. And these things take real amounts of time to rebuild, right? I mean, if you look from, like, you know, this sort of, you know, dot-com bust to when, you know, sort of companies really started getting founding again and venture capital started flowing, like, it took almost a decade, right? In some ways, you know, sort of 2001 through 2009 were kind of like the lost years in the world of sort of, you know, software companies and venture capital. For sure, there's obviously some great companies that got founded in that time frame and things that got funded, but nowhere near the level that we've seen from, you know, in comparison 2011, let's say, to now, you know, 2021. So for sure, you know,
you know, space is even more vulnerable than software was, right? You know, it's even further out time frames. At least, you know, in like the dot-com bubble, there were sort of, you know, companies with like great fundamentals. And for sure in space there are, but they're very reliant on other space companies versus, you know, at least like the PayPals of the world, you know, weren't reliant on other internet companies. They were just reliant on consumers. So it's an incredibly, you know, let's say delicate flower of an ecosystem. And, you know, there are some parts of it that are sort of longer time frames. So, you know, for example, during COVID, it actually didn't really hurt a lot of these companies because most of their customers were on such long contracts and time frames that, like, you know, one single, you know, sort of shock didn't really matter, especially since it recovered so quickly. But if you had a, you know, COVID level or increased shock that then lasted, you know, a year, I don't know if the space ecosystem is mature enough yet that it would like readily recover, and it could really slow things down by like 10 years. And so, yeah, definitely something that we think about it a lot, you know, at Varda is sort of, what would our nuclear winter plan be? What would we do if sort of that type of shock were to happen?
Yeah, no, hopefully we don't get to that world. And a last couple of questions. One is on the space industry, because obviously you've been an observer, let's say, of the space industry over the years, and you've looked at it from the outside, and now you've kind of got into the industry as well, being part of the industry in the best way possible, I'd say. What do you think the space industry not do well, or what do you think they can improve on? Because obviously there's, you know, so many things that, you know, you can look at. Maybe it can be from the commercial angle or marketing. Some people say they don't market enough, you know, they don't sell their vision enough, they focus too much on the technology, etc. I've heard a lot of things from people, but I'd be keen on getting your perspective on, you know, what the space industry can do better.
Yeah, I think, you know, it kind of comes down to some of my critiques earlier, which is just like, you know, less focus on R&D and more focus on like commercialization, and, you know, more focus on independent commercialization away from sort of federal government, you know, type, you know, programs, in particular NASA, since it's like such a research-based organization, right? You know, Air Force, Space Force, things like that make a little bit more sense to me because they are more focused on sort of dual use and wanting things sort of like to be commercially viable versus, you know, a lot of the work that NASA does is explicitly trying to not be commercially viable anytime soon. And so that's probably like my, you know, biggest critique. And then it's just like, you know, ideally sort of more people having the ambition to actually like go and start their companies. I mean, for sure you're starting to see this now, like now on a much more regular cadence, you're seeing people sort of leave Blue Origin, SpaceX, et cetera, and like start space companies. But that wasn't the case even 2 or 3 years ago. Most of them would just prefer to stay at these sort of larger companies and sort of ride that out, as opposed to take the risk of, you know, starting their own thing. And so, yeah, maybe a little bit more ambition, a little bit less reliance on this type of R&D infrastructure and funding.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, I have so many questions that I can ask, and perhaps there's probably going to be a part two once, you know, your new announcement comes in October, November. I want to end with one final question. So what's your favorite hat to wear? You've been a space observer or a space advocate, and you have the hat of a space tech VC, and then finally, you're now a space entrepreneur. So what's the favorite hat?
Yeah, in some ways, it's like what I like the most is when I get to wear all the hats. Like, you know, for example, in this podcast, right? Like, in some ways, I'm getting to wear all hats. I'm getting to pitch Varda. I'm getting to talk about like the space ecosystem and the companies that I get to invest in, and I'm getting to like act as a space advocate. And so, if anything, it's like part of what I, you know, really, really like about, you know, the sort of, I don't know, job that I've orchestrated or architected for myself is the fact that, like, for sure, in some ways, like, I actually don't love it as much when I just have to wear one hat, right? Like, when I'm, you know, just having to be a space investor or just having to, you know, do something in relation to Varda or just being a space advocate. Those times, in some ways, are, like, less fun. It's the times when I get to sort of wear all the hats that is much more, you know, fun for me, since, like, there's just very few people that, you know, are in this position where they get to wear sort of so many different hats at one time. And so these are definitely, you know, by far sort of like my favorite moments of my job. There's a lot of not fun moments, it turns out, you know, when you're trying to build companies or when you're trying to fund things or, you know, when you're trying to advocate for an industry that's very nascent. But, you know, it's worth it for the fun moments.
Absolutely. Yeah. Brilliant. Thank you. Thank you, Dillian. I think that was a brilliant note to end the podcast on. And you've already, you know, inspired a lot of people to get into the space industry. And I think you continue to do that. So I hope you continue to do that. And good luck with Varda, and good luck with your investments, and good luck with the space advocacy for all you three hats. And thanks for being on the podcast.
Thanks. Yeah. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, this is Arvind again. Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the TerraWatt Space Podcast on your favorite podcasting platform. Also, feel free to sign up for my newsletter, TerraWatch on Substack, that is terrawatch.substack.com, where I attempt to decode the recent developments in space tech and its impact on Earth. Thanks again, and hope to see you for the next episode.